Persecution, Trial, and Tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal presents the number 29 tape in this series of vital and intense interest to every Christian. Your speaker will be Mr. Raymond Cole.
We've been going through this matter of trials for some time, and all I can say is I sympathize with you. I'd like to get this done, but I don't want to skip over any particular facet of it because I think it is relatively important. And when we finally go through those times and those circumstances, we're going to become extremely aware of the value of perhaps the instruction that has been presently received. It is vital, it is awesomely important that we understand why we're experiencing the things that we are, and we're going to go through them. I've stressed that over and over and over. So let it not be a strange or unusual thing to anybody that he experiences trials. You know, the trials can come physically, mentally, emotionally, and in every other way. They can come by our temptation to subscribe to the around, our circumstances, to be like unto others, to perform many of these things, you know, that make us a part and parcel with our society, or to subscribe to their way of thinking. These are the things that are going to affect us. And we're going to be subjected to that from time to time, because it is decreed by God. Well, the last time, and because of an urgency to cover as much of this as I can today, and yet give you the succinct detail without going into a tremendous amount of elaboration, I want to get right into the subject and move along as rapidly as I can. Now, we started into the subtopic, how we can evaluate our complete environment, the events, conditions, circumstances, and experiences, because it is indeed a must. We must be able to evaluate these conditions, the times, the circumstances, and the events, because nobody can miss out on the circumstances of life. We are living in this life, and therefore we are a part of the events, the conditions, the circumstances, and the experiences. There's no way out of that. We cannot exist in a vacuum. Therefore, there is an indigenous purpose for these things which we experience. The last time, and in order that we might effectively tie it in, I want to turn once again to the last text that I gave to you, Galatians, the 6th chapter, and note verse 4. Galatians 6, and noting verse 4. We read, of course, verses 1 through 9, one of the most meaningful and significant series of texts in the entire Bible. But here in Galatians 6 and verse 4, it says, "Let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone, and not in another." As I said to you, and I've said many, many times, at various locations, the word prove does not mean to sit down mathematically and to ascertain the accuracy of something, or even to rationalize its truthfulness or error. It means to live it. Let us prove it by living. You know, when we are asked to prove God, and indeed we are asked to do that, it doesn't mean, now I'm going to sit down and prove whether there is a God or not. It doesn't mean that at all. What it means is to substantiate God's promises and the assurances which he has given to us. Live in accord with those demands, conditions, commandments God has laid upon us, and become aware of God's responses to us. That's what it means. Prove God does not mean to certify his existence, to prove our own value, our own lives rather, does not mean to certify them. It means to live what God has required of us. That's the responsibility incumbent upon us, and that's the word proof throughout the Bible. I've gone through it time after time after time. It has nothing to do with this old concept that you prove the truth because you sit down and you subject it to a test to find out whether it is truth or not. I don't care whether we come up with the idea that truth is not truth or not. Truth is still truth. And the only way you're going to ever have it is if God reveals it to you. Now, when God reveals it to you, I can't conceive of God turning around and saying, I want you to sit down and find out whether it is truth or not. Does that make sense? Of course not. So he said, let every man prove his own work. In other words, set about the responsibility and see the results. Now, if we reap the blessings of God, then it paid dividends, didn't it? If we are cursed, then we need once again to look into our lives for the whys. That's the proving that is required of us. And the word prove there is the literal word that we're talking about, and we're still in the subject of dokimazo, or trials. The word here, dokimazo, is the word prove, which is translated basically as trial. Now, if we were to insert it, let every man subject to trial his own work, which is exactly what it's saying. Now, next, I want us to notice Ephesians 5 and verse 10. Ephesians, the fifth chapter, and verse 10 says this, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord. The word there is dokimazo once again. D-O-K-I-M-A-Z-O. Remember, the M-A-Z-O oftentimes has the anglicized sound of a D in it. So it's a dokimazo, at least as the so-called experts anglicize it. Now, what the Greeks will say, I'm not sure, but I'm not here to fight about Greek and Hebrew because there's no way that we can speak it, but we nonetheless know what it is in definition and in its purpose, and that is the important thing. It is amazing how people will overlook the real purpose of a statement, a comment, because they want to argue about a technicality. You know, that's the courts of our lands today. They can't see the purpose, but they'll argue about technicalities. And nearly every case is won or lost on technicalities. Not on the issue that was presented at all. Well, you know, God is not that kind of a judge. You're not going to get by with a lot of technicalities, because it's the real purpose with which we're going to be evaluated. So we're to prove then what is acceptable unto the Lord, or that is to be subjected unto trial, and therefore render evidence acceptable to God. That's what he is saying. Now let's go back to the first verse and see if we can't get it in context. Be therefore followers of God, you dear children, or as dear children, and walk in love as children also hath loved us, or as Christ, pardon me, also hath loved us, and hath given himself for us an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named among you as becometh saints, neither filthiness. So you see, he's talking about the conduct of our lives, isn't he? The way we live, our behavioral patterns, our attitudes, our responses. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no man deceive you with vain words. In other words, somebody coming along with deceptive concepts. He's preaching or he's teaching something that is foreign and contrary. So how in the world are you going to ascertain this? There's only one way, because you know what the divine truth is. Everybody else is deceived. A deception against deception. Only those to whom God has revealed his truth, in other words, the called, know and can evaluate. Everybody else is involved in one form of deception or another. Some are deceived by deception, and it just keeps proliferating. So he said, let no man deceive you with vain words. The only way you're going to avoid that is if you have the faith once delivered and you refuse to relinquish it. For because of these things comes the wrath of God upon the children of disobedience. Be not you therefore partakers with them, for you were sometimes darkness, but now are you light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth. Proving, notice the context once again, what you're living. Proving the value, in other words, of living the right way versus living the type of a life indicated above. Proving what is acceptable unto the Lord, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. That is a command of God. So as we're subjected to the trials, the tyranny of the trials of life, we're proving the value of God's will and of God's way of life. And the value is in implicit obedience all the way. Perfect obedience before God. For these other ways do not pay dividends. Not at all. Philippians 1 and verse 10. Philippians 1, and let's note verse 10. That you may approve things that are excellent. The word approve here, by having been subjected to trial, you have seen the evidence. That's what it's talking about. That you may approve things that are excellent. How do you approve? Is it left up to you to make the determination of what right is and what wrong is? No. Not at all. Then how in the world do you approve what is right versus what is wrong? By the life you live, you substantiate that which is unalterable. That you may approve things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ. Let's notice it in context now. Verse 9. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment. What knowledge? Revealed knowledge. What judgment? The judgment of God with respect to yourselves. For remember, you are not licensed to judge anyone else. So if it is in knowledge and judgment, it is knowledge revealed, and it is the judgment of yourselves. If it is the judgment of self, what judgment is it then? Your behavior, isn't it? What you're doing, what you're thinking, what you allow or permit, what you condone. These are the critical issues. Now, verse 11, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ under the glory and praise of God. In other words, live those principles. That's what he is saying. Filled with the fruits of righteousness. He didn't say that we're going to prove whether they are really the fruits of righteousness or not, but by those fruits of righteousness, we're going to prove the value of our own personal conduct. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, forever now, brethren, we're going to knock the pins right out under the people that believe 1 Thessalonians 5:21 means that they have a right to prove what the truth is. No, they don't. Nobody has ever had that right. The only people that will ever have a right to it are those called of God. And then God reveals it. And once God has revealed it, you have the right then, by faith, to remain consistently loyal thereto. But you don't have a right to prove whether it is or not. How in the world could you do it anyway? You mean you and I can elevate ourselves to a third plane above God to determine whether truth is really truth or not? Because as human beings, you can't know the spiritual knowledge anyway. Then how in the name of good common sense are you going to prove what truth is as a human being? You can't do it. There's no way of it. But we can live it, and by our experiences, prove its value, which is exactly what it's saying here. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21. Prove all things and hold fast that which is good. In other words, where in this text does it say that here is a container containing both good and bad? Now, you're going to prove everything in there. Some are good and some are bad. So you're going to hold to that which is good, but you're going to reject that which is bad. The only one that could make that determination is God. And God has already determined what is good and what is bad. You and I are going to come to appreciate it by the trials and experiences of life. We're going to realize its value, its intrinsic value. So we prove all things then, and we hold fast to that which is good, which is the truth of God. The truth that has to be revealed. And when it's given to us by continual operation or action in that respect, we realize its unending value, and with faithful loyalty, we adhere thereto. We don't give it up. You know why people begin to drift aside? Because they have allowed the value of truth to become blurred or darkened by virtue of their own aspirations or their own hopes or their own physical desires or fears or misgivings. But at any rate, it involves all the weaknesses of the flesh, of the mind, of the heart, and of the flesh. But we are called upon to prove all things and to hold fast that which is good. Next point is, we prove ourselves by those things which we allow, confidently, doubtfully, or arrogantly. We prove ourselves by those things which we allow. Romans 14, and let's note verses 19 through 23 with emphasis upon verse 22, and I'll call the word to your attention. Romans 14, and beginning in verse 19. Let us therefore follow after the things which make for peace, and things wherewith one may edify another. This is our pursuit, it's our behavioral pattern, or must be. For meat destroys not the work of God. You know, it is amazing how many people are insistent upon their physical rights, regardless of who may be destroyed spiritually. Oh, I've heard them many, many times. You know, especially people, let's say, that are heavily involved with drinking. And they say, you know, God allows it, and I'm not about to give it up. But, you know, if we offend somebody with drinking, we are guilty of the death and the failure of that individual. That means, my dear brethren, we are our brother's keepers. Which means that we must be cognizant of those things which offend and trouble others. I'm no perfect example, but I'll tell you one thing. Many, many times I have deliberately avoided saying or doing certain things for one of two reasons. Either because I didn't know what the reaction would be, or because I did know, and I avoided it deliberately. Because the Bible tells us very clearly that if we offend one of these little ones, because of something we demand physically for ourselves, we're guilty then of the spiritual life of that individual. So he said here, once again in verse 19, let us therefore follow after the things that make for peace, and things wherewith one may edify another. For meat destroys not the work of God. If I don't get a drink, you know, a particular night, and you don't have to worry about me because I don't drink anyway. I just haven't for who knows how long. Or a sip, maybe. But that's it, because my constitution just simply won't take it. And I'm not about to insist on that right to my own detriment. I don't find that much satisfaction in it. But I don't condemn anybody who does, because the Bible says that it's fine. I know that. But at the same time, what if there is somebody who does not really comprehend this? Now, I'm not talking about somebody who willfully decides that he or she doesn't want it the other way, who's already, you know, in a bad spirit. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a weak babe, somebody who perhaps has not grown to that point, who does not comprehend. Then you are responsible. For meat destroys not the work of God. All things indeed are pure, but it is evil for that man who eats with offense. I'll have it, doesn't make any difference. That's an evil. It is good neither to eat flesh, nor to drink wine, nor anything whereby your brother stumbles, or is offended, or is made weak. Now notice, hast thou faith? That's fine. Somebody has that faith and that confidence in God, there's nothing wrong with it. But wisely and judiciously use your faith, is what he is saying. Hast thou faith? Have it to thyself before God. Don't offend somebody else, he is saying. Happy is he that condemneth not himself in that thing which he alloweth. The term alloweth is the dokimazo. Same word. Experience has not disrupted him in this respect or this regard. Meat by experience has been well received. It's beneficent. It adds to his pleasure before God. He has that faith and that confidence. That's fine. Except when we impede upon the faith and the conviction of somebody else. Then he is saying, don't do it. Don't do it. The Apostle Paul set us the example, and he said, if meat were to offend my brother, he said, I won't eat it the rest of my life. How many of us will make that kind of a sacrifice for our brother or sister? And then verse 23, and he that doubteth is damned if he eat. What he is saying is, don't compel somebody else to do it because of your faith. That's fine for you to live up to your faith. But if your faith is such that it does not trouble you or plague you in that regard, then don't impact upon the life and the faith of your brother or sister. For if you compel him to do it, and he doubts, he is damned if he eats or drinks. It's critical, because it is an MO of life. Or a modus operandi. It is awfully significant. You see, God is weighing us in our outlook. Not only what we do day by day, but our philosophy of life. How do we view things? How do we view our brothers and sisters? How do we view our trials and our difficulties? God is weighing all these things. He that doubts is damned if he eat, because he eats not of faith. For whatsoever is not of faith is sin. Now that's critical. I mean, it isn't just a matter of compelling somebody else to do what you want them to do. If we had real love and affection for our brother or sister and we realized that there were a doubt there, we would encourage them not to do it until they had proven it to themselves by experience, by their own trials. Next, point number 7. Initially, God tries the servants he chooses to use. God's going to try them. And it's exactly the same word here. In 1 Thessalonians 2, 1 Thessalonians, the 2nd chapter, and let's read the first 4 verses. We may want to go beyond, but let me see. 1 Thessalonians, the 2nd chapter, and beginning in verse 1. For yourselves, brethren, know our entrance in unto you, that it was not in vain, that is, without purpose. But even after that we had suffered before and were shamefully entreated, as you know, at Philippi, we were bold in our God to speak unto you the gospel of God with much contention. For our exhortation was not of deceit, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile, but as we were allowed of God to be put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, which tries our hearts. The word here, or there are 2 words, both the word allowed and the word trieth. Now notice it. But as we, speaking of the ministry, were allowed, that is, God having subjected them to trial, to experience. You know, it's just like when you read the qualifications of a local elder. He says, not a novice, lest they should be lifted up in their own pride. Does God pick novices and put them in then? No. They're tried. Now, that doesn't mean that they'll always endure to the end. But God subjects them to the trial, and they're proven by those experiences, those trials. Now, notice. So as we were dokimazo, or subjected to trial, of God to be put in trust with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God which tries or subjects us to these various trials of our hearts. So God has not only tried, but will continually try to keep them in that proper posture before him at all times. So the ministry is going to be tried too. So is everyone. They're all going to be tried. Because remember, you are to assume awesome responsibilities at that appointed time. In 1 Timothy 3 now, 1 Timothy 3, beginning in verse 8 and reading through 13, but emphasis upon verse 10. 1 Timothy 3. And beginning in verse 8. Likewise, and here I'm reading the very thing, except in this case it's the deacons, or it means simply servants. For this is a word that means servants here. The word for deacon means a servant. It's not a special, you know, just like the ministry is a servant. These are words that mean servants. The minister is a servant. He's not a tyrant. Well, unfortunately, some are. But I mean, a true minister is a servant. And so is a true deacon. It just simply means one who serves. Now notice what he said. Likewise must the deacons, or meaning a servant, be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy of filthy lucre, holding the mystery of the faith in a pure conscience. That is, he is loyal to the truth which has been given to him. And let these first be proved. How do you prove them? In other words, let me illustrate it, because I have Leon here before me, who is a servant of God. So when we decided that we were going to ordain Leon, first thing we had to do is find out whether he's Leon. We had to find out whether he's really human. We had to subject him to the acid test. That's the way we were going to prove him. See, that's what people think. That's the common conception. No, it wasn't that at all. When the discussions took place, he was given the responsibility and observed. That's the proving process. Let these first be tried. You subject them to the experience. It wasn't that we had to find out whether he lived or not. We saw him. So it wasn't a matter of proving whether he was or he wasn't. It was a matter of finding out what he was as a being. And that comes by proving. So let these also first be proved, which means also means likewise. Likewise with reference to what? Well, the earlier definition is of one who went into the local ministry. Let them use the office of a deacon, being found blameless. Even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. Let the deacons or servants be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well. If deacons had to be the husbands of one wife, which means there better not be a single doubt, imagine what's happened to some of the ministry. I guess they can't even read the word one, O-N-E. Well, they probably mean one at a time. One after another. What is that, Sandy, that eats these chips, or these wheat thins, isn't it? She's standing out in the wheat field, and she says, you know how I like them best? One right after another. So that's the way these men are. They like them one right after another. No, my dear brethren, what it means is a matter of living it. It is a matter of proving it. Now I want you to notice 1 John 4. 1 John, the 4th chapter, and beginning in verse 1. Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits. Now, how are you going to try them? And who are you trying in the first place? But try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. In other words, the spirits then that is being addressed here are those spirits motivating those who profess to be the servants of God. Now they are to be tried. How are they to be tried? Hereby know you the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. Now, how would that do it? Well, who is Jesus Christ? The Word of God. The way, the life. Did he not say that he was the Word of God in John, the 1st chapter, verses 1 and 14? Did he not say also in John 14 and verse 6, that I am the way, I am the life, and I am the truth? Do those things ever change? Did he not also say in Hebrews, the 13th chapter and verse 8, Jesus Christ, the same, yesterday, today, and forever? Then he who denies Jesus Christ is one who makes him a changeable Christ. The only way you're a servant of God is if you have Christ. Because it says very clearly that if you have not that Spirit, then you're none of his. If you do have it, it's consistent. It never changes. It's just a mathematical equation. So then, the logical conclusion is, anybody who says that it changes is speaking by a spirit that is not of God. So you are to try them. How are you going to try them? You have only one way. By the divinely revealed truth. That's the basis of all evaluation. The next word, dokime. D-O-K-I-M-E-E. D-O-K-I-M-E-E. The definition is experience is the basic intent and characteristic of the word. It distinctly relates to a track record how one reacts and responds. For other words that are used, and I'm not going to use all of them because I'm selecting only the words where it is used as trial or a comparable expression, but it is translated as follows: experience, proof, trial, or experiment. Experience, proof, trial, or experiment. Now, maybe I am covering all of them. Perhaps I am. I didn't specifically note on it. No, what I'm saying is there are other root words. That's what it is. There are other root words from this, but I am not using those root words. So if you wanted to expand and go to the other cognates, you could do that very easily. So I am covering this word completely. D-O-K-I-M-E-E, which means then experience, proof, trial, or experiment. And it is that basic intent or that characteristic of the word itself. It is a trial or an experience. Now, how is it used? The end product is the proof of something, isn't it? The end product is the proof of something. It's its substantiation. And it also is the production or the manifestation of its purpose and character. When you see the process, because remember the word means a trial or an experience. So then in retrospect, you look back, it is the manifested proof of an end. Just like we say, you know, concerning a beverage, an alcoholic beverage, you know, that is so much proof. You know what it is only when the product is there. It's the end product. It is its substantiation. But at the same time, in looking back then over the process, it is the manifestation of its purpose and character. Because now you can look back in retrospect and you can see its manifestations. Here in Romans 5, and let's note verse 4. Romans 5, noting verse 4. The first usage. And patience, experience, and experience, hope. Both words, experience here, are the word dokimi. Now let's go back and see if we can't get it in context. And not only so, but we glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation works patience, and patience, experience. So experience is not, experience can be viewed in two different ways. The experience of the trial itself, or the sum total of the trial in its manifestation, the end product. When you say, I've had plenty of experience, it doesn't mean that you're going through the unique set of circumstances right at that moment, does it? It means you have gone through them. And you know the whys and the wherefores. You have a certain expertise that goes with it. So notice what he said once again. And not only so, but we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation works patience, and patience experience, and then experience produces hope. So here is the logical production of these finer traits and characteristics. So it is an end product, but it also is a stepping stone to something else. The stepping stone to hope. Hope that makes not ashamed, as we find in Colossians 1 and, what is it, verse 27? No, it isn't there either. Christ in us, the hope of glory. Wherever it is, the hope that, well, yeah, that's here in the next very next verse. And hope makes not ashamed, because the love of God is shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, which is given unto us. So then, the word then does mean the product of those things which we have experienced, the trials and the difficulties of life. 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 9. 2 Corinthians 2 and noting verse 9. Paul writes to the church at Corinth, for to this end also did I write, that I might know the proof of you. In other words, the reason for the letter is to find the reaction, their response that I might know the proof of you. Paul was writing over there to find out if they were truly Corinthians or not. No, the proof that he was seeking was their behavior or their response. He wanted to know. For to this end also did I write, that I might know the proof of you, whether you be obedient in all things. So God himself, as well as sometimes circumstances and conditions of life, subject us to trials and experiences. And you know, we don't always come out the best, do we? Because when we look back in retrospect, we can look at it and say, oh, if I could, you know, if I had just known what I know now, and look back, you know, I know that I could have done a whole lot better. It is difficult, very difficult, to be objective, to use vision, and to use it wisely and discreetly, because the present seems so awesome and looming, so imposing. And if we could just assert our rights right at this moment, you know, it would give us some satisfaction because we're sure we're right. But why does it create doubt in the years, the days, and the weeks that follow? Philippians 2 and verse 22. Philippians 2 and verse 22. Paul writing now to the church at Philippi, but you know the proof of him, that as a son with a father, he hath served with me in the gospel. In other words, the people now were concerned about another minister. And the Apostle Paul takes the time out to say, remember the past? Remember the service and the dedication and the loyalty? He said, you know the proof of him. It's already there. That as a son with a father, he hath served with me in the gospel. So it has to do then with a product, the end product. And what did our trials and our experiences produce? Excellent substantiation for our character, for our tenacity, our loyalty, our faithfulness, the manifestation of the glory and the beauty of the character of God, consistency, real manifestation of spiritual qualities. Is that what we see manifested in our lives and in the lives of others? Next, it is a testing process, the proof of purpose or belief. In 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 2, 2 Corinthians 8, and let's note verse 2. How that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. This was in relationship to the need of others. And the word here is the word trial. They went through a great trial. But oftentimes the trials that others experience are golden opportunities for the rest of us to manifest the character that we should have learned through our own trials. That's why they're there. And so the Apostle Paul said, how that in a great trial of affliction, these were the people up in Corinth, you know, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. So in other words, there were certain people who had desperate need, and the others took the occasion to manifest the character, the proof of their character, the proof of their own trials and experiences. I say once again, my dear brethren, are we our brother's keepers? You bet we are. It means that we are not to be nosy with respect to their individual lives, but that we are to be ever aware of their needs. Areas where we should be responsive, to pray for them, to render a service of benevolence or kindness where possible. But at the same time, it is incumbent upon others to let us know, too, because we can't always know. And certainly it is absolutely essential that others let us know. In 2 Chronicles 9, and let's note verse 13. Whilst by the experiment of this ministration they glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ and for your liberal distribution unto them and unto all men. In this case, the word experiment. Notice it. While by the experiment of this ministration, or the various trials of this administration, what he's talking about. Our present administration, which is the same one that we're experiencing right now. And there are experiments also that we're going through. And that by this experiment, we are then to manifest the glory and the beauty of the finished product of that experience. That's the hope and the expectation incumbent upon us. And the last point now, the last point for this word, and I'm not going to go beyond this because I would get into the next word, but we have made good progress today, and I'm grateful for that, so we'll conclude this before too very long. The last one now with this dokime, D-O-K-I-M-E-E, is that it is evidence or a manifestation of claim or action. It is evidence or the manifestation of a claim or action. In 2 Corinthians 13, and let's note verse 3. Since you seek a proof of Christ speaking in me, which to you word is not weak, but is mighty to you, for though he was crucified through weakness, yet he lives by the power of God. For we also are weak in him, but we shall live with him by the power of God toward you. Notice, let's go back now to verse 1 and get it in context. This is the third time I am coming to you. In other words, he was promising to come, but he never made the third trip. In the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. So what he is saying is, if I come once again, here is the third time. I told you before, that is on the first appearance, and foretell you as if I were present the second time, and being absent now I write to them which heretofore have sinned, and to all others that I come again, I will not spare, since you seek a proof of Christ speaking in me. What had come to pass by this time is tremendous perversion already had racked the church at Corinth. If you will remember, time and time again, I won't go through all the details of it, where he speaks of that perversion, the corruption of God's word, that they had turned away from the very foundation that had been laid, and remember this, how they were gloating and glorying in this man of sin that existed within the body, and he finally said, get rid of him. But then later on said, let him come back that he might not be consumed with overmuch sorrow, and so on. In other words, the Corinthian church was absolutely rift with problems. And indeed it was. If you want the true history of it, just go back and read both books. There were divisions. They were following Apollo. They were following Peter. They were following this man and that man. They were troubled and perplexed. They had established false premises or foundations. Remember, he went through that. And he said, no other foundation can be laid except that which is Jesus Christ. Now, keep this in mind when he says, since you seek a proof of Christ speaking in me. By this time, the Corinthian church were challenging Paul. And what were they saying? Well, in context, I think it becomes pretty clear. They were saying, now, the apostles, we understand, Peter, James, and John, you know, they were willing to accept them because they never had any authority or power in the lives of the Corinthians. So they were willing to accept the existence of apostles that they had never seen. Just like people are today, they're willing to accept Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They're willing to accept the prophets of old, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Hosea, and so on. But what if those men stood in their presence today and told them, these people, the same things they told ancient Israel? They would spurn them and reject them and say, you're no servant of mine. You see, they conjure up in their own minds what they would say. Because to every man who is right in his own sight, who believes that Hosea is a wise and a marvelous servant, that he would be substantiated in his own conceptions. Why, the man is absolutely convinced that Hosea would say exactly the same thing he thinks. That's why they're willing to give credence to them, but they have never accepted them in their own day. Paul was the servant to the Gentiles, and the Corinthians had now begun to question him. He said, "Since you seek then a proof of Christ speaking in me." You go on and read the rest of it, and you will find what proof was given. He said, "You'd better examine yourselves." Isn't that what we find in 2 Corinthians 13? The problem was not with Paul. The problem was with those people, because they were examining Paul instead of examining themselves. They had better examine themselves. Each one of us has the responsibility to examine himself. If we will tenaciously cling to that which has been proven, ancient Israel saw the proof of God over and over in how God benefited them, blessed them with every blessing when they obeyed. But they saw some 20 different times the proof or the consequences of their mistakes when they were sent into captivity, brutalized until they cried out to God and supplicated God once again. He delivered them again. Until he finally had to divorce them and he just threw them away. He said, "Learn your lesson till you come to your senses." Yes, brethren, we look back. We saw the proof of what we have accepted. It wrought beautiful things in our lives. Why should we give it up? It didn't come because the name of a man or of an organization. It came because of God's truth, our relationship with God. That's the proof. That's what Paul is talking about. The substantiation of that way of life is the truth once revealed. And we must maintain it in faith. So it is then the evidence or the manifestation of a claim or any action taken. It's the end product. And we need to examine ourselves and look. Are we still the recipients of it? Are we as a group being blessed? Are we as individuals being blessed? Are we the recipients of God's awesome love, his kindness, his affection? If so, then the proof of Christ is within us. We have living within us Christ. And when Christ is living within us, we have all that glory, that power, that beauty, the manifestation of that character, the divine nature. That's what the word means. Now, we're trying ourselves only in relationship to that. The faith once delivered. Next time, brethren, we're going to pick up the word dokimion, another cognate, and I think you're going to be, I think I can complete it next time. So that will complete this subject on trials and tribulations.
Persecution, trial, and tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the number 29 tape in this series of vital and intense interest to every Christian. Your speaker has been Mr. Raymond Cole.